Hi everyone, welcome to our Twitter Spaces event. Thank you very much for joining us. I'll hand you over to Neil, who is going to host this event, but I'll be here if anyone needs anything. Over to you, Neil.
Hi everybody, and thank you so much for joining us. I realize it's kind of a dense evening for media, so I appreciate you taking some time to hang out with us for a bit. I'm Neil Romanek. I'm the editor of Feed Magazine, and we cover innovations in media and broadcast and try to help content creators use new technologies in new and better ways that will help their viewers and also help their bottom line. I'll run down our list of guests, and they can quickly introduce themselves, and then we'll jump right into it. We have we're going to stop at 5 o'clock Eastern Time. That's 10 o'clock p.m. in the UK, where I'm talking from. But after that, we don't have to vacate the room because another bunch of people are coming in. We have some time to chat after that if you want to talk to any of the speakers, if you want to network or continue the conversation, or exchange ideas. We have time for that afterwards. So if we don't get to your questions, or there's something you feel like we've overlooked, or you have a great point you want to raise, stick around afterwards and we can keep talking. So I'll just, as I said, I'll go ahead and ask our speakers to introduce themselves quickly and just tell us where they're from and what they do, and we'll get into the discussion. Holly, do you want to jump in first?
Sure thing. My name is Holly Choi, and I'm the executive director at EIDR, and that's the Entertainment Identifier Registry. So we register all the media and entertainment content that is out in the world.
Great, thanks. And Tiran?
Hi, everyone. My name is Tiran Nagan. I'm CDO and head of industry solutions for Cognizant, which is a big tech firm. We're 300,000 employees strong and growing. We build industry solutions for the communications, media, and technology, high-tech space. That's the area that I cover. And great to be here.
Thanks, Tiran. Lisa?
I think Lisa's currently connecting.
Oh, is she? Okay. We'll go to Guy then. Guy Finley?
Hey, it's Guy Finley. I'm the president and CEO of MESA, the Media Entertainment Services Alliance. We're hosting the Innovation Zone inside of the Intelligent Content Pavilion at NAB.
Oh, nice.
Great. Mary?
Hi, I am Mary Yurkovic. I am the Director of Smart Content at MESA Online. And for MESA, I help bring the technology leaders together to solve some of the most pressing issues in the industry. As well as help educate the community.
Great. Thanks, Jonathan.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan Glazier, and I'm an entertainment producer and director. I work all over the world. I used to be the head of entertainment at the BBC here in the UK, where I'm based. And I work across all the kind of digital spaces, terrestrial, video on demand, and I'm a consultant for many major broadcasters around the world.
Great, thanks. Eddie?
Yeah, hey, I am Eddie Vaca. I am help leading growth and platform monetization here at 90 Seconds. We are a global production house helping both production teams and marketers get content to market quicker.
Thanks. Pedro?
Yeah, I'm one of Eddie's colleagues. I'm a production services manager with 90 Seconds, but my background is in content creation, primarily video editing and concept creation, developing scripts and things like that. So for me, this chat is super interesting.
Great. Lisa, are you with us?
It still says connecting.
Okay. Well, I'll introduce Lisa for her. We have Lisa Griffin. She's executive director of MEDCA. That's the M&E Data Center Alliance. And hopefully she'll get hooked up here shortly and she'll be able to jump into the conversation. So what you're here for. It's intelligent content. The title of the talk, our discussion is What Intelligent Content Means for Content Creators. And you probably might be asking yourself, what is intelligent content? And one of the things that kind of sticks out to me is that, you know, content used to be something that was very much handcrafted. You know, we were kind of like the blacksmiths or Renaissance painters or something. You know, you're like Michelangelo lying on his back in the Sistine Chapel, and you create something and you present it to an audience or a buyer, and you hopefully then you get your money back, and maybe you've made some money for some other people as well, you know. But that old kind of way of doing things is becoming more and more practical and kind of almost impossible with the so many platforms, so many formats, so many different ways of creating content and so much demand for content. And content is really, I have a piece in the upcoming issue of Feed about this actually, which is going to be out in March. But content is really almost becoming a commodity, really, that's kind of used almost as fuel for this big giant money-making engine that we call the entertainment industry. And you have to be able to produce content at scale now. You can't make it, you know, you can't make it by hand. So I think, you know, one way forward is to look at this idea of intelligent content that we're going to talk about today and kind of just ask what that means. What is intelligent content? And kind of one way of looking at it, it's content which is designed kind of from the ground up to be used for multiple purposes on multiple platforms and multiple technologies. You know, it's got data built into it, so it's kind of rich with data and metadata, which makes it easy to kind of find and use and reuse and adapt to different formats. And it's kind of, in a way, almost been created by the data and is going to be used to generate more data. I mean, you could say it's like a product of and a fuel for this modern media entertainment industry machine that we're constantly feeding. And there's sort of a dystopian angle on that where we're just shoveling content into this big furnace and trying to get money out the other end. But also there could be some really interesting and potentially beautiful things that can come out of that as well. And maybe we'll get into some of that today and kind of talk about, you know, what are the advantages for business and for creatives in that. So maybe we'll kind of get on just that creative side. And I'm going to ask, the first question is, you know, what does this idea of intelligent content, and you can maybe talk about what your kind of definition of it is personally, but what does it mean actually for creation, for content creation itself? And maybe we can start off. Do you want to start with that?
Sure. Happy to. You kind of gave a hodgepodge of a whole bunch of things on what intelligent content is, but I mean, for us here at 90, it's about creating content or stories that actually drive action, right? So we work with a lot of brands. We work with a lot of brands that are creating massive amounts of content. And like you said, they throw it in at the top. Hopefully something at the bottom comes out and they go from there. And then when it does, they rinse and repeat and create more and more and more of that. So intelligent content from a brand standpoint is something that, as you mentioned, is something that you can kind of use over and over again, some evergreen content that they're creating, but also assembling it in a way that it doesn't feel that it's being reused, because brands want that kind of, that they want that exclusiveness to the content that they're using. They don't want to seem like they're just kind of purchasing stock content or footage from different places, or that they're just reusing assets they've already had. So when it comes to intelligent and kind of distributing that content, it is about using it in a way that they can grow from it, but also where it looks new and fresh as they put it out into market.
That's interesting. Mary, do you have a take on that?
Yes, actually, I do. When you talk about, you know, what does intelligent content mean for content creation? From my standpoint, it, you know, much to what Eddie just said, and in addition to that, it's really collaboration. Also, you know, being able to collaborate with coworkers wherever they are to make this content super smart, so they can maintain a brand's integrity and get out meaningful content to the universe.
That, I mean, I to add on to that, Mary, is exactly that, right? Is mm-hmm. And what Neil said earlier was, how do you make content at scale? Like, if you're not making it at scale, and we're talking about a global economy, like how do you even start to put your toe into that pond? Where at 90 Seconds, like we're a global production house. So if you're working on something in the US, we can take that same asset, same brand, and drop it right into France and recreate or reuse, again, intelligent content and spin up the exact same thing, regionalized for that. For
right.
That
localization. But absolutely.
Localization. Yep.
Yeah.
So it is that thing. The image that comes to mind is like you just have to make more content, but it's not necessarily about making more.
Well, it actually is, because we're in the, you know, we're in the middle of a content explosion right now inside of our industry. You know, studios that used to do about, you know, anywhere between 75 and 100 projects a year are now doing between 750 and 1,000. So there, it is speaking to kind of where our business is going, and it's mostly attributed to, you know, streaming and global access to content via all these streaming services. And I'm not just talking about kind of the seven sisters that we all know and love, right? The Peacocks, the Hulus, the Disney Pluses, the big ones of the world, Netflix, Amazon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I could go on. But think of the 200 other over-the-top service providers that are serving, you know, local, regional, and national content, but just not necessarily, you know, America. But really, when you talk about what is intelligent content, you got to speak to the bits that surround that content. And how we enrich that content when we create it, so that if there is something that's been created that could be reused and repurposed in another piece of content, we actually can do that, because the way we've made content for years, you would never know. So much stuff ends up on the cutting room floor and never gets reused ever again. It was just a cost attributed with a series or a feature. So, I mean, that's something that we've done for the last 7 years at Mesa is really driving that idea that the more data you infuse into the product, and the more that you don't strip things away, and you essentially keep all of that metadata associated with that content as you greenlit it and created it, and then as you distributed it, and of course, as you know, there's no longer archived now, it's always on and available in various forms, free and monetized. But that's the whole idea, is from inception to infinity, making sure that the data that goes along with that content is as important as, sometimes even more important than, the content itself.
That's really interesting. Tiran, do you have a take on that as well?
Absolutely. And so first of all, for the folks who are listening and they're thinking, why is a, you know, big IT firm here talking about the content side? You'll find that Cognizant is in a chokehold of content, and we service the enterprise customers, all of those big brands that you had mentioned. And the way that we look at it is intelligent content is across the entire value chain. So intelligent content being produced could be, how do you introduce automation to create that scale that you talked about, churning out a lot of materials. And we have, for instance, clients that we've helped create automated content production platforms where they can create, you know, taking elements and patching them together, clearly on more on the low end of quality, all the way to custom creative. So that's on the production side. But if you traverse this downstream, you produce it, you package it, you distribute it, intelligent content automation is in every part of that supply chain. How do you quickly do the post and use rules? For instance, if you're doing international distribution and you need to do S&P standards, and you, rather than relying on attorneys to review every piece of content for local compliance, you can use rule-based automation. Or if on the distribution side, how do you make sure, for instance, that the QoE and the measurement of the experience gives you not only live metrics, but you can act on it. So we see intelligence in every one of those. And if I look at, for instance, Holly and a potential implementation of either, where you can see every element from the provenance of every asset that is used to create content, that's one type of intelligence. But there is intelligence in every aspect of producing, creating, and distributing.
Great. Jonathan, do you have something to add to that?
Yeah, look, I was going to say, I think intelligent content has been around for ages, since the days of the Muppet Show. we would produce M&E tracks so that you could repurpose the Muppet Show in any territory in the world with the music and effects. So nobody ever had to redo the music and effects. They just put on new voices. You know, that's the kind of first example in my career that I came across, if you like, repurposing. And now I'm just about to embark on a format that I came up with, which is being produced in Asia, where we have the need to, and going to what Tiran said, to fully automate that kind of thing. But it's using artificial intelligence to grab the highlights of streams. And we all know there are lots of examples of intelligent software that will grab a gamer's stream and just pick the highs and lows. There's still a human being at the end of it that makes sure that, you know, you can weave that into a story. But, you know, I think artificial content goes across the whole board, from repurposing things like, you know, it starts at the ground up, like Weakest Link. You know, we don't just make opening titles. We make sure we make opening titles with intelligent layers so that in any language you can repurpose the same base title and then put the foreign language title over the top for, you know, Weakest Link in German or whatever it happens to be. So I think this idea has been around for a long time. I think it's been incredibly labor intensive. And I welcome anything that Cognizant can do to cut out the repetitive tedium of doing that. And I don't mind how intelligent it gets. And I think, you know, and I'm not frightened of it. I think it's a good thing.
Well, that actually, you got into some of the aspects of like the actual creation there. And I think that's the, I mean, you know, the content obviously is not intelligent. You know, it's humans are intelligent. Content is not intelligent. But it kind of points to what kinds of ways do we need to think when we create this stuff to get the full advantage out of this intelligent content. Like, I mean, the great example there is, you know, the Muppet Show. Beforehand, you know you're going to do that and you're going to save time down the line and you're going to have many more opportunities down the line if you do it in that way. So, like, looking at, like, pre-production, production, post, what are some of the kind of new ways you can think about using the data, using intelligent production, thinking in different ways about producing your content? Because this can start, I guess, right from the very, very beginning. Rather than, as you were saying, having all the stuff on the cutting room floor, you can kind of think ahead and go, well, no, we don't need to have all this stuff on the cutting room floor. We're going to do ABC. So did somebody want to talk about that, about how you can kind of start planning and thinking about productions differently from the very beginning?
Yeah, I think that one, actually. Mm-hmm. Just to start off anyways, I can actually give a case study to that. I have a large investment company that was a client of mine before I came to 90, who once asked me, they basically are an umbrella that runs, I don't know, something like 90 organizations internationally. So they said to me, we need a lot of internal content all the time, and we just don't have the means to keep sending people on small projects. So we kind of crafted that around them. And what we did was we took a year and went to every location and did directed shoots for 3 days at a time. So we just captured everyone we thought was interesting for an interview, every location, every B-roll shot. We put together little sequences while we were there talking to people and produced content. And at the end of that year, we had so much content that today, nearly 10 years later, I'm still cutting content from them with that material. Now it's the resolution and everything's gone a little bit, you know, outdated, but it's time to do another year's worth of shoots.
Pedro, I can build on that as well. So, you know, it's interesting because you're so right. And this doesn't have to be like, oh, you know, all the B-roll from the Avengers that they shot in Manhattan, you know, 10 years ago. So there's a gentleman at Sony Pictures that runs their entire clip catalog. But by successfully tagging and identifying all of the shots that they had in their library, and it's literally hundreds of thousands of shots, he was like, we'll never have to go shoot a wave ever again, right? You know, a wave crashing is a good interstitial to cut between scenes. And he was like, for look, sure. I've got waves in rain, I've got waves in sun, I got breaking left, I've got breaking right.
So if you're able to get closer to your wife.
Yep, sorry about that. That would help. Let me get to a better spot, But Pedro, I think you know what I'm talking about. That's exactly that use case.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, if you go and you shoot, and for even for other clients, you know, sometimes we'll be at a resort or something like that, and we need sunsets. So we just capture sunsets for 10 days at a time. At the end of, we've got enough sunsets for the next 10 years.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And it's having the right tools in place, as both of you guys were saying, capturing the right data about that content so it's smart, you can repurpose it, and having the right tools from the very beginning, from pre-production, capturing that information, the data up front, so you know what it is, and ensuring it's consistent. Yeah, there's nothing worse than zillions of spreadsheets.
Yeah, well, and the idea also of going back and actually doing that post, you know, afterwards and coming, taking it back to the home office and then cataloging. So I was just at the HPA Tech Retreat, which is like the premier production summit for Hollywood. And the idea is they're capturing this data in real time and it's feeding right directly into platforms. So you're not capturing it, then taking all the assets back and saying, all right, team, you know, go catalog this and tag it. That's the part of smart content that's really cool. And what's happened in the last, 10 years is, and people like Cognizant know this very well, because they've got systems that can take that raw kind of feed and interpolate it in real time so that you're not wasting the resource, 10, 15, 20 days down the road, let alone 10, 15, 20 years.
It almost begs the question, do we need a standard, in the same way that cameras operate with a standard metadata kind of language, do we need that for the abstract as well? I'm looking at sound effects libraries, and I know sound effects libraries quite well, but often their descriptions are quite, abstract. And so if you're looking as an editor for a whoosh or some sort of transitional sound effect, it has to be tagged in the right way in the first place and kind of consistently tagged. Otherwise, you get a whole variety of whooshes that you don't want.
So Guy knows that what he just said is a trigger for me. But when I take a step back about the technology and intelligent content, if I look, the folks who probably are listening in were attracted with the keywords around content creation, because that's probably more leaning towards the production side. And what should I do as a content creator to be part of this intelligent content future? And the things that that you guys have just touched on, they really go to the core of the enterprise technology platforms, the stuff that we live and breathe, that Cognizant does, and you guys as well, whether it's content discovery or search and experience. And the question is, what should the individual creator in their span of control be doing? Because I can tell you, with one of the large, how you call them, the Seven Sisters, if you go and search for content, whoever you are, you get exactly the same result, and it's a matrix of 9 results. They're not personalized, and some of this is not about designing user interface. It's a complete breakdown in media supply chain, metadata enrichment, all of that automatic tagging, and the opportunity to do AI enhanced visual recognition to find stuff in frames. All of this really hinges on the starting point. Who's creating the content, and how are they enriching the media supply chain? And then how does it stream all the way down to the viewer, the mm-hmm. one who experiences it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we've all had that, experience of being on a big platform, getting excited to watch a movie, and then finally all the millions of dollars that have gone into creating that movie end up with the thing that you are presented with, some weird metadata that's not quite right, and the information about the movie is wrong, and you can't quite find what you want to, it's just that this metadata bottleneck at the very end ends up spoiling all the work that's gone before it potentially. So I mean, can you start thinking about that from the very beginning, as you were saying, and kind of what do you need to be thinking about in order to make sure that down the line you're going to get the maximum bang for your buck?
So I'd like to add there, I think that's a great point. And one of the things that I know Disney has done, I worked over there for a little while, and one of the things that they did was they actually put metadata under brand management, because it absolutely impacts your brand if your metadata is junk, right? So it's really important to be able to identify your content and to have good supporting metadata so that the viewer actually is getting what they think they're getting, right?
I think to that point, it's like it's been the job of ad agencies forever to make sure that people are clicking and watching and engaging. And And maybe the authenticity has been left behind a little bit in creating that metadata.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I was going to speak also to Jonathan saying, hey, we need some standards around this. And yes, we do need some definitely best practices. But I think what's also happened is the technology is getting better where that, you know, that single source of truth is not one single source anymore. And if you look at the difference between some of the metadata providers out there, and that's the other grand irony, right? If the content creator doesn't make that metadata and associate it with its content and say, this is the content creator's metadata, it'll end up getting created by a company or by crowdsource and end up, you know, some studios will even go back and buy metadata for their own product that they created in the first place. I mean, so that's the part where
you're absolutely right. And in fact, you know, we recently partnered with Gracenote and a few other companies. And one of the things that we were seeing, it's actually servers that we are now developing, is we're seeing a gap between what the industry thinks that a service provider has and what they expose. And sometimes it's just a matter of them not reporting properly or not taking down assets from their discovery process. And this gap is going to be, increasingly, it's going to be a challenge. It's plaguing all the large media content platforms. And it's a challenge for us from an experience perspective.
I think we also have to be very aware of tag security and metadata tag security in the broad sense of the word, because just take the kind of black and the white and the word truth and lie. And if you apply it to news, if somebody gets in and says, you know, this isn't true, then a whole heap of content can be kind of blacklisted very simply and very easily as we develop these systems. And so I think you have to make sure that, you know, the way and the technology behind the metadata is really secure and cannot be influenced by large, even state-sponsored third parties.
Interesting. So what about, this kind of brings up the question of AI and kind of automating some of these things. And obviously there are a lot of kind of getting better and better solutions out there for being able to do certain kinds of metadata at scale with AI, being able to find all kinds of interesting bits of data to pull out of your content using AI. Is that specifically on the metadata? And we can also get into the larger part. How does AI help? And is it a real practical solution in working with this?
I love AI. I just want to say this because there's a really good thing on BBC Sounds at the moment about translation programs and how translation programs work. And they said something really interesting, that you cannot find a translation directly between Finnish and Swahili because no human being has ever translated Finnish into Swahili because it always goes via English as the third party. And so it comes to the same old, you know, bad programming in, bad programming out. And I think it's the same with tagging and with metadata. You know, if you don't find an intelligent way of marrying up the picture to the tag or marrying up the content to the tag or whatever else, it is a system that just is doomed to failure, and that you have to be absolutely certain. And even with language translation programs at the moment, people are not convinced in, well, my lifetime is going to be shorter than most of the listeners, that you're never going to have a serious conversation with a computer where you don't know that, you know, it doesn't pass the Turing test, because we can, you know, bare arms is a classic. I tell my daughter not to go out and bare arms, but it's also part of the Constitution of the United States and America. It's two very different things, and you need the whole contextual argument. So coming up with, and I'd be interested to hear again what Tiran says about that, about ways of AI automating the tedium of tagging things and using metadata correctly is a whole minefield.
Yeah, I have to add to that, because at the end of the day, when you think about these people in pre-production, production, post-production, any of the creative people, do they really want to tag content when they're on site? And, you know, unless you're a librarian or that's your job to be putting these words somewhere and ensuring that those words are specific, it's very tedious. And that's where AI is awesome. And it can do like incredible things, being consistent, adding enrichment to content.
Well, Mary, are you saying that cameramen are not going to spend 20 minutes before they start shooting to enter it into the camera?
I'm sure they get a big fat raise at the end of the year if they enter 10 words every time they click.
Well,
we would need another person on set for sure. Well,
exactly. That's what I was going to say. You know, welcome the new DIT. Yeah. You know, what's most interesting here also is we're at the nascent early stages, right? Because AI needs to learn, right? Machine learning needs to learn first before it can do anything. But the reality is when you think about frame level metadata, right? This is what we're talking about. Frame level metadata, where in that frame, what's in it? Rugs, vases, lights, people. We can't do that as humans. It's impossible. So what we're trying to do is teach the computers on the object rich condition side, and then tying that to the taggers, right? But the taggers are also, those are 80%, just like in localization, those are 80% done by machine. We still will always need the human to kind of say, yes, that actually is that, and put the final stamp on it. But we're getting so much closer to that nirvana where we can actually feed it into a system, and it's giving us that information on scale. And that's metadata at scale, frame level metadata. And ultimately, we'll see that in our life, you know, probably within the next 10 years. But that's when it gets really fun and interesting, because then you can make the connections with that content that weren't even really even thought of before we had that access. And I think that's the holy grail, really, when we get down to it. But there's no way we're going to pay humans to do any of that other than to say, okay, that machine is right.
Yeah. I think we're closer than 10 years out. I think we're right around the corner from it, really, because when you start recognizing rugs and tabletops and people inside video, you can then correlate that back to the audio track that's there, and then pull out that information and say, oh, hey, this was, you know, John, he was sitting on XYZ couch and he was drinking a cup of tea from Starbucks. The logo was on the cup or something like that. So like, I think we're a lot closer than what you think. And you're right. It's metadata at scale, and there's technology out there already that is learning. And we're creating, yep. I forget who said it earlier, but like an explosion of content. We're doing hundreds of years of content a day, not just from, you know, the Hulus, but from brands. Brands became media companies overnight, where you have, you know, Salesforce and Microsoft putting up these huge events, creating OTT channels for B2B content. And I think if those guys are able to kind of huddle around and start using this tech, we're there so much faster than a decade away.
And do you think that what about the AIs or AI being used to actually start producing content? And you know, the sci-fi scenario is you just press a button and you know you it spits out a bunch of files and you upload those files and
they're
home early.
There's some groundbreaking work going on at the ETC, the Entertainment Technology Center at USC, around that, of like, you know, figuring out how the machine can make content. But I think really where that becomes a reality is when you get to lower, not lower level, but more broader content. And I'm not just talking reality shows. I'm also talking about local station content. I do think that we'll have machines creating some of that as we move forward. And then, or at least the skeleton around it. But I don't know if Hollywood's ever going to trust a machine on a $20-$40 million budget. I think we're a ways away from that.
Well, I
think it speaks a lot to process.
Yeah.
Well, the process for an editor, for example, so many things have become automated as far as like rotoscoping, which you used to have clients would pay for 2 weeks of work just to get something green screened out. Now you can do it literally in a click. It's unreal.
So, Pedro, I think you touched on exactly what is the role for AI, because that's probably the fundamental question that's inferred here. On the top of the scale, pure content creation, it's not happening. And I'll probably eat my words in 3 years when someone invents that. but if you look at the rest of the spectrum, there's some very tactical stuff, whether it's rotoscoping or, you know, the edit process or SNP or metadata enrichment. And even that has layers, because it's one thing for you to throw a video clip and get millions of keywords of every object found in every frame and what to do about it, it's another. And this is actually one of the things that we are actively building is what about mood detection? Because that allows you to do things such as better personalization. And that automation process of knowing the content, the one thing that we didn't talk about is how does this all relate to the monetization? Whether it's the user engagement, but more importantly, there's another side that's very important to support the creative production, and that's the advertising and the holy grail of the right ad against the right viewer at the right time is ripe for this AI. And I'll end with my point of view is the automation of tactical steps using machine learning to do them increasingly better is right in front of us, and there's an amazing innovation. And then the things that go further into creative automation of, for instance, template-based production is low-end quality in my, you know, that's my personal judgment, and we're not seeing a lot of demand for that yet in the market.
I think, this is really interesting because I think AI, to an extent, is an exercise in probability. And then it's providing that probability with a context and looking at the probable outcomes. And I think in this data-driven society, where we all look at keywording on our websites, on our blog posts, where we all look at the probability that that keyword's going to be high-performing, and that we all know that there are probability programs, and they are basically probability programs. But however, if you put all that into a machine learning computer, it can come up with some pretty interesting results at the end of it for a really good hit blog post. And if you look at all the blog post AI that's out there, AnyWords and all of those kind of things, they are essentially, you know, a kind of Grammarly stroke translation stroke probability against the keywords. But it's still really interesting that it can come out with successful blog posts that do rate highly on searches. Now, creatively, the argument is, well, how good is the end product? Or is it just rating high and it's kind of almost like clickbait? So I think, you know, the it's kind of where you add the human being into the equation as opposed to where you add the AI into the equation that's interesting to me.
But it's in, I mean, if it's clickbait, I mean, what if you just want some clicks? I mean, that sounds great, right? If you can have an AI spit out something, regardless of what we might call quality of content, if it can spit out something that you know is going to get traffic on your site and drive
totally
ad revenue.
Maybe that traffic's a little fickle, no? Because if I click on it and then I find out that, oh, well, the information isn't here, it loses credibility as a source in a way.
Yeah. Plus one.
Well, that's it. It's the authority behind it, isn't it? As you're absolutely right, you know, we've all clicked on clickbait and thought this is just junk and you never try and go to that website again. So that's the key to the whole process. You know, it's the same with, you know, putting a search into Google and they've done some brilliant SEO and you get something that's just junk because it's just full of SEO and what you want is the content.
We should be careful.
All come up with a great title for a movie and a good byline, you know, in space, no one can hear you scream, but you want the actual story behind that.
Hmm. Well, I think it is important to have authoritative sources, right? Like if you're training your machine learning, you know, knowing what are authoritative sources is really going to be able to drive some of that. So I think there is control available for this, right? Like, I don't think that it's just, you necessarily just turn your bot loose and let it just pick out anything it wants.
Mm. So. We're talking about AI as like being a labor-saving device, you know, and that kind of making things easier, making things simpler, being able to do things at scale. But in terms of like creating quality content, you know, most quality content is about sort of facing how difficult it's going to be and being brave and going for it, you know. So kind of flipping it on its head, I mean, is there AI, you know, can we partner with AI in ways that can really push us to do something that we hadn't thought of before, or, you know, something that's not just labor saving, but actually kind of pushes us forward into something brand new? I don't know what that would be, but I mean, can you envision what some of those things might be using AI to create content in really new ways?
I think, you know, since Jane Eyre, the narrative kind of flow hasn't changed. And you kind of look at the way these books are written, particularly classic English literature, you know, beginning, middle and end. And we've even strived for that in kind of the way we write scripts. So that Save the Cat came out in what, 19, whenever it came out. And people have been using that template for a long time and other templates to write their movie scripts and kind of write in all their beat points and all the rest of it. It's kind of like, you know, you can easily envisage AI doing something like that. But it's about the content still at the end of it. But the thing that interests me is now we're seeing more and more kind of broken narrative and the use of flashback and flash forward. There's a great thing, I think it's called Suspicion, is it, on Apple at the moment, where, you know, the narrative is really broken up through the thing. And it's kind of like, I think that's the trend in drama at the moment, certainly kind of, you know, the kind of Netflix video on demand drama, where the narrative arc is broken up into flash forwards and flashbacks. You have to have your wits about you to watch it. But AI didn't come up with that. It was a disruptive human being that came up with that.
So it's going to, you think it's just going to stay a dumb tool that we use to just save ourselves some work?
Not necessarily. I mean, IBM, I think back in 2017 was playing around with using Watson for, you know, to create, write articles. And if I'm not mistaken, there is a startup, Articulu, that was doing it. If your example is writing scripts or creating some initial treatment for content, that's very different than the holy grail of, will it also create the script? Will it give me the you know, A rolls and B rolls and assemble it together? That's a completely different creative task.
And Tiernan, I was going to bring up also the, you know, the AI that wrote music, right? The AI that wrote the Nirvana song. I don't know if anybody. But the whole idea there is that I don't think that's what intelligent content's about, because you know, being an auteur and being a creative and making something that you love, even if it's the, you know, the Real Housewives of, you know, Boise, Idaho, or whatever it ends up being, there's still passion behind those projects. And I think it's really, it's not dangerous, right? Because there will be some use cases, but I think it's important to be like, the machines are not going to take over on some of that, because it was Chris Nolan that you know, created Memento. That wasn't a computer. Mm. And we'll always have those groundbreakers come in and that flash of creative genius, and then we'll take it, and then the machines can learn it, and then we can create a local version of it, right?
I agree. And you know, maybe the way to frame this is that machine learning is great at replacing human decision making, not necessarily the creative part. So being able to judge will this content perform well in this particular scenario, that's something that's machine learnable. But actually creating the content is a completely different problem space.
I think if something gives you a starting point or gives you, you know, help along the way. I'm dyslexic. I take a lot of, you know, advice from machine learning algorithms when I'm writing and when I'm spelling. And it's great. And, you know, if something gives me the space, that's what I crave. You know, we're all time poor. And if AI does all my metadata and does all the stuff that is just tedious and boring and gives me time to sit down and think, that's brilliant. That's the work-life balance I want.
I always thought, I mean, I'm a screenwriter as well, and just that idea of being able to sort of use AI or something to just find connections that I wouldn't have normally been able to see, or find, you know, aesthetic or character or plot connections and loops or moments that wouldn't have been apparent to me just by looking at it by myself, I think is interesting.
That's it.
Do you think, I mean, is it, so we're not in danger of losing our jobs to AI, you don't think?
Some jobs.
Jobs? But there's so much work out there. I mean, so you have a skill set in typing, okay, we'll go back to my scenario of typing words into a spreadsheet, right? You're going to find, there's so much work within the studios. You can find another area of focus there. You know, I think, again, it's taking away, AI will initially help us take away some of these tedious jobs that no one wants to do and help connect the dots for us to become more creative and spend time writing screenplays and just creating amazing content.
Dear God, if I was a transcription writer, I would welcome AI to do that for me. I just can't think of anything worse. Unless you just enjoy watching television end of and typing out what people are saying, get a computer to do it.
Yeah, you become a finisher rather than the bulk of it. The 80% of the job's done, and then you put the final 20% and add that real human element to it that no machine, or at least that's where maybe 10 years is the right path. But, you know, that no machine can actually do that actual nuance of, oh, no, that's the way we say it, this in Catalan.
Or somebody just says something simple. But, you know, it's like, you know, we inflect the end of our sentence to ask a question. But in any other context, it feels like a statement. Or we say it in an angry voice. You know, that's the thing that a computer or even a transcript can't change. But a human person can put in brackets, you know, said with feeling or something. I don't know.
It reminds me of the Avengers movie, right? When Tony Stark is, hey, I need to run this complex physics thing. Asks his computer, hey, can you run this for me? He came up with the idea of like, hey, if you put these two things together, will it work? The computer did the work to go out and find the solution to it. As you guys were talking, I just thought of that. So I was just like, hey, let me... Anyways, but yeah, I thought it's very interesting that you can't replace the creative in this aspect. Like we're always going to be the ones that come up with the idea, and then the machines will be like, "Hey,
you have to ask yourself as well
this idea for me."
Would a computer have been able to write the script for Don't Look Up? Because does a computer understand irony and satire? You know, I don't think so. I don't think they will in my lifetime. You know, it just wouldn't happen, I don't think.
That speaks also to the training part of it. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Pedro.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no. I was just going to say, I think it speaks a lot to the nuance element that you had mentioned earlier. And Jonathan, when you said now about intonation, I watch a lot of like UFC YouTube news video channels, and a couple of them adopted voiceover through AI. And you can always tell when it's a AI one, because it literally has no correct intonation. Stops don't happen at the right time. Pronunciation of names especially just go right out the window. Whereas a like a journalist would know that name. He would say it correctly.
And even it's very subtle. I mean, the awful events of today, I've seen a couple of YouTube clips that have had exactly that treatment. They've been AI voiceovered. And then you listen to the real thing and you hear the pauses as the emotion is in the reporter's heart, looking at this awful situation unfolding before us. Yeah, and these AI things turn that into a complete joke because they just read like a traffic direction.
Well, there is that too. I mean, if an AI could write write a script perfectly and we couldn't tell whether it was written by a human, does it matter? And I think maybe it does, because I mean, ultimately, depending, obviously, there are all kinds of different content, but some of the content that we know and love, it's important that a person wrote it. We want another person to have transmitted an experience to us. You know, it's a communication between people. It's not just a chunk of content.
Sure. The best stories are the ones that no one's ever told, right? So if a machine has to rely on sources to come up with a story to tell you, right, it's only going to have access to the information that's already available, right? So I do think that the creative element of humans will still need to be there for us to feel like it's fresh and new and something I've never seen before.
I think also, you know, the human element, you know, is something unbelievable. I heard somebody say tonight that, you know, Biden comes under a lot of criticism for being an older president and all the rest of it. But, you know, somebody said to him, there's nothing more powerful than listening to a man with the experiences that he's had talk about today and the lessons that we should be learning from history and how we move forward. Yeah, that's powerful. You know, you don't get that from AI. You get that from human experience. You get that from what we all know as human experience. And so while I welcome AI and think it's a brilliant tool, unless I was a transcription writer or a court reporter, I don't know that I would be that concerned.
So it should be the AI. The AI should always be pointing towards the humans eventually. It should always be in service to what the human needs at the end.
Yeah, I mean, does anybody really think, you know, Terminator and what is it, Psycho or whatever they were called? That's Simon Cowell's company. What was Psycho? The people that made the Terminators and the kind of AI took the world. Does anybody see that as a reality?
Well, yeah, Elon Musk and Bill Gates.
Yes. Elon Musk is the one who's warning us that they will take over the world.
They will, yes, indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
Or have they already? So I mean, does that? Yeah, I mean, on a personal level, how do you think it's going to affect you and your career, and just specifically what you guys are doing individually?
I'm just worried about the precogs, generally. The precogs coming after me for something I didn't do yet.
Yeah, exactly. The knock on the door.
I can say that as a creator.
Go ahead, Pedro.
Sorry, just for me, like with editing and filming, it's helped so much in small ways. When I think of, you know, autofocus and face detection and things like that have gone into creating content, it's been such a leap forward to and slimmed down processes and made it more. You know, cameras have gotten smaller in editing. My post production processes have gotten faster. And it allows me to be more creative. So if anything, in a weird way, AI is actually helping me to be more human and more present in the moment.
You're not having to be like a monk in the Middle Ages, having to mix your own ink, you know, before you sit down to write.
Well, exactly. So the mechanical and tedium to free us up for the things that humans are really good at.
Let me also take it to the next level around virtual production as well, right? Because that's a big buzzword going on, right? Virtual production, metaverse, Web3. But when you look at what the sets are now for virtual production, there's 40 different systems talking to each other, right? Between camera and lights, it's all automated. They're pinging outside sources. They're uploading into platforms. And the idea of a creative, you know, a director even thinking about that, you know, he's going to turn to his or her trusted confidant and say, hey, are we good to go here? It needs to be seamless. That's the part where if we don't start thinking about this en masse as an industry and start applying this across the board, it will only stay in that 1% of filmmaking. And I think that's what the big point out of HPA also was, is yes, this is the tip of the spear, but this will be in every single newsroom. It'll be in every ad agency. That idea that all of these systems are talking to each other, no, that's for the systems people. And Tiran, you said it best. It's preparing content for the enterprise, but not having it feel like it's from the enterprise, like it's IT.
Guy, but what you really are highlighting is you almost brought us back to our starting point, which is this is all about scale. And scale doesn't mean that you're going to now go work 25 hours a day to go and shoot. It means that if it's a post-production and the ability to use AI, for instance, to match between people with distributed skill sets for post who are a fit for my virtual production house, and there are companies who have done this in the past, then that's one side of scale. Or the other one is the example that we were talking about earlier, where AI enables me to not worry about every tiny little setting in my photography so that I can really focus on the creative. And all of these are about scale, productivity, and using AI to enhance us in that space.
And it might be, I mean, is it also something that actually can help sort of smaller companies and mid-tier companies? Because if I'm a giant production, I'm going to get, you know, the top people anyway. They're not going to want to do auto anything, at least like in terms of the craft, you know, they want to be able to hands-on with everything. But there were cases I know in the pandemic where there were kind of, you know, AI-driven cameras and productions that were kind of very agile and very light that used a lot of automation that they, you know, wouldn't have been able to really come up with a budget to do something on a big scale. But sort of AI and virtual sets and automated systems allowed them to do stuff that they wouldn't have been able to do.
It speaks to the creator economy for sure, Neil, right? I mean, that whole idea, I go back to the music business a lot just because that's my own personal background. And ultimately, the idea that, you know, you used to have to make, you know, you guys have to spend $1 million to get what's basically in every MacBook now with GarageBand, right? You literally had to spend that money. And if you think about that analogy of where we are now and where it's going, you know, the creator economy and not necessarily our top-level producers and directors, but the TikTok artists, the UGC, it's only going to get that much better because it'll become pre-programmed with algorithms and again, things that have been developed using AI and machine learning and taking, you know, maybe it'll be like, oh, it's almost like on a Mac when you say, oh, I want those photos presented in the Ken Burns mode. You know, it's almost like that. I do think that it'll take it'll take what we think of as the great auteurs, the Spielbergs, the Scorseses, and it'll start saying like, oh, much like in music where it's like, oh, I want the Eddie Van Halen guitar sound, and I push the button and poof, I have it. Now, I don't sound like Eddie Van Halen, but that guitar sound certainly does it. So that's the thing that I think is exciting, is it's going to branch out and be exposed to millions of creators. And that's when it really gets fun, because they'll do wacky things with it that we never even thought of. Just because of the nature of the content they're creating is passion only. It's not driven by money or a schedule or anything like that. So that's the tertiary benefit of all this great technology, is it will end up evolving what we think of as content creating.
I think, you know, it's very true. And I you know, all through my career, I've been about giving people voices, and, you know, and I think the kind of democratic voice that's available through the availability of technology now and the democratization of content is really key. I sound one note of caution within that, as somebody that sifts through a fair amount of TikTok, YouTube and blah, 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 is that it's really disappointing that with all the content that's created, I very rarely stop and go, wow. You know, when you think of the access that people have, there's so much imitation, there's so much of all the things that human beings have been doing time immemorial. And maybe I need an AI to just show me the stuff that's different.
Indeed. By the way, that's the music, Jonathan. That's exactly what the music business is going through right now. So much content that it's like, how do you really get to the gems? It changed the whole entire business. And I think that's also what we're going through as film and television. You know, we're looking at a whole new world ahead of us, and we're looking in the past saying like, okay, I hope we don't get that broad, you know, because I do think that it makes it more difficult to find the real gems to really, you know, to have that excellence really pop out.
I agree.
Well, the recommendation engines from like Netflix and Facebook and such put us in wormholes, but I mean, Netflix itself, it recommends the best shows that they think I would like based on my viewing habits, right? It gets a little convoluted when, you know, my 8-year-old jumps in there and starts watching Dora, but that's a different thing. Recommendation engines are already doing this for us. They're saying, hey, watch this instead because you're going to like it X times better. And that intelligence already exists.
And that's a shame, isn't it? I went to a conference of librarians, believe it or not, and it was the kind of beginning of Google, and the fear that they had that everybody was just going to look at the top of the pile Google search. And of course, the really intelligent students, well, hopefully they'd come up with original thought, or they would go to the last page on Google and the least searched and the least offered result to find something new and interesting.
Yeah, getting that sort of serendipity of things you wouldn't have normally expected, or that nobody knew that you wanted.
Yeah,
we're going to have to wrap up here in a bit. Maybe we could just kind of go around the panel and just leave the listeners with, you know, what should they know for the future? If you had to sort of give them one sort of intelligent content tip that they could take with them to think about or maybe try out in, you know, their own business or their own creative pursuits, or just something to chew on, what would it be? Anybody want to start?
Okay, I'll start. I would say use the free trial and try everything. So it's as simple as that. You know,
oh, that's a good one.
Find the tools that suit your business and that you think you can make use of, because they're tools. So use the free trial, and then if you like it, sign up.
Great.
I think Jonathan spoke for me.
Yeah. Or you can just, anybody can just jump in. What else?
Yeah, for businesses or people who are afraid of artificial intelligence, you know, from a change management perspective, change is hard. I don't think that AI is going to take over their job immediately, or if they have a manual job, it may take it over, but it gives an opportunity to try something new. I mean, there's so much discoverability, as we just mentioned earlier, about things that can be discovered, and there's just new avenues you can go on to.
And I agree with Mary. To Mary's point, I think, you know, those people who have been looking at that data forever and ever, those become your governance experts at that point, right? So I think use the tech in new and inventive ways, like maybe use it to introspect a file to find out how many frames per second is this content or whatever, right? So I think there are just other ways that you can use it that even now humans aren't that good at it. So
yeah, so between get as many free trials and try something new, I would split it because I have the enterprise primarily as a viewpoint. If you're an enterprise, assume that there is a lot of innovation outside of your company. Work with partners that are innovative and can bring to life your vision. For individuals or content creators, just a little pointed tip, you can go and open an account for free on both IBM Watson and Google's APIs, and you can even use demo apps to play around with their AI engines and see, you know, throw document in and see what it identifies and how it can identify the construct of sentences or the emotive value of the text that you're creating, and see how would you innovate. And reach out to people. I would love to network with people who have thoughts and ideas. And I would love it if the solutions that we build for large enterprise and major media companies that help them improve how they personalize and customize the experience for the viewers can be applied for other folks who are outside of the enterprise. And I'm open to engaging on that conversation.
Taryn, I'll follow up to you as well. We've had smart content for a few years. We have a community of over 70 companies and about 10,000 subscribers. I'm inviting people down to that zone inside of the Intelligent Content Pavilion to meet with these people. We've been focusing on this, and we have so many subgroups and smaller, not only EITR and obviously Medca also. I should mention that because all of this advanced, sophisticated software needs to run on hardware, and that's what that data center alliance is about. Also, is about building your facility correctly to be able to handle the throughput and the sheer volume of information that is being transacted on a literally second by second. But I'm inviting people down to come meet some of these people who have been the one percenters and the tip of the spear simply because of budget, and to understand the proof of concepts that we've pioneered, and to also say, how can this apply to my business and to my particular situation, where am I, if I'm a local or a regional or even somebody that has a few stations. I think it's really going to be exciting to get broadcast engaged on the intelligent content side at NAB in April. So we're really just excited to be there in force with all the associations underneath the Mesa umbrella.
Absolutely. I love it. It's all about ecosystems, baby, right? And because I look at acquisitions and M&A, I always look with, one eye forward. Can this be really enrich what we can take to industry? So that's a great approach, Guy.
Indeed. And I see that Neil has dropped off. Emma, I know we're wrapping up. Eddie and Pedro, did you have any final comments? Oh, I see Neil's a listener. But Eddie and Pedro, did you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, really quickly, just two nuggets. If you're a brand, think globally, act locally, right? Hyper-localized content, it's going to take you further. And then if you are a creator, keep innovating. It is important to keep pushing the envelope from a creative standpoint. And it is a sure way to not be replaced by the robots.
Thanks, guys, yeah, for jumping in there.
Hold on, Pedro, got one last
moment. Go.
Nope, I was just going to say, a lot of what everyone said to me rings so true. Try everything, make everything. Keep pushing that envelope, and don't worry about AI. It's only coming to help.
Great. Thank you so much, everybody. It's been a really fabulous, interesting discussion. Connect with everybody. We're really looking forward to the show in April, and we'll be continuing to make content in this space, so keep your eyes open. Thanks again, everybody. Have a wonderful day, evening, night, wherever you are, and hopefully come to our next one.
Great.
Cheers, Emma. Cheers. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.